Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. It's just Anoush and Stephen this week as Alba's on holiday. We talk about Boris Johnson's visit to Scotland and the Conservatives' attitude towards the Union. And you ask us, how do you feel about Number 10's shake-up of Whitehall comms? So we're recording on a day where Boris Johnson is visiting Scotland and he's been talking up the, in inverted commas, sheer might of the UK Union. And the thought is that he's gone to visit out of fear of the SNP's ongoing power and popularity and the threat that Scotland could opt for independence. And of course, we have the Holyrood elections coming up next year. Stephen, what is the true purpose behind the Prime Minister's visit, do you think?
I think it actually is one of those things where it kind of semi does do what it says on the tin, right? In the for a long time, and indeed, you know, both Alistair Jack, Boris Johnson's, I mean, when I say handpicked, what I mean is basically to differentiate than the other. Alistair Jack was his first choice for Secretary of State for Scotland. They are politically quite close. So, you know, it's when I say Alistair Jack said, look, the election to decide whether or not we should, yeah, whether or not there should be another referendum is the Scottish parliamentary one. It wasn't like, you know, some guy who happened to like be an available Scottish politician like shooting the breeze in a sort of unhelpful way. That is a pretty good guide to where the party leadership is slash was on the issue. Mm. David Mundell, the previous Scottish secretary, who's someone who is not as much inside the tent, had also said that. Now, of course, it looks fairly likely that the SNP will win an outright majority, then there'll be even more pro-independence MSPs in the next Scottish Parliament than there are in this one. So it is partly about kind of doing the sort of like, this is going wrong, we need to work out a way of turning this around. Mm. But it is also, the analogy one Conservative MP used to me, who is also an Arsenal fan, was at the start of the season, a lot of kind of supporters organisations did a statement which was shared under the hashtag WeCareDU about the club's ownership and the fact that they've, like, you know, overseen the kind of gradual emasculation of the most successful manager in the club's history, a utterly disastrous CEO, you know, seizing control of, it's a subject of considerable pain to me, which is getting us off the actual use of this analogy, right? but what the fans wanted is they wanted some sign from the club's owners that they understood that things were bad and then this bothered them as well. I think there is an extent to which, and one of the things in a lot of MPs, because although it is fair to say that, you know, the average MP, I think basically of all parties, other, of course, than the parties which compete in Northern Ireland and have seats there, but actually then, if Northern Ireland were to go independent, a Conservative Prime Minister would not have to resign. If Scotland were to go independent, yeah, you would get however many letters it is for a no confidence, you would have people resigning from the cabinet saying, you know, this is the greatest defeat for our party for, you know, for in its entire history. It would be a moment of extreme emotional and political trauma. And I think there is an element to which this is, and they've said, look, it's their We Care to You moment. Mm. When in the wake of that statement, Arsenal broke their transfer record to sign Nicolas Pepe. And as with Nicolas Pepe, where it's not clear where he actually fit in the tactical vision, such as it was, of the then coach Unai Emery, it's not actually clear to what extent this kind of Boris Johnson goes to Scotland is like going to, you know, has any kind of policy meet or what he's actually hoping to accomplish. But it does, I think, attest to the fact that a lot of Conservative MPs are seriously worried about the relationship between Scotland and the rest of the UK.
And what's really interesting is I feel like some of the rhetoric from this visit has been thought through quite poorly, considering what you've just said, that it's a matter of such grave importance to them. You would have thought that they've thought it through slightly more, because drawing attention to the coronavirus response and saying that, you know, the UK was responsible for all sorts of things that have helped out Scottish people, which of course they have with the furlough scheme, for example, just draws attention to the differences, I think, between Scotland and England's responses. Because really, I do think that the coronavirus response has been a story of devolution in a way, because those key services that have been required to step up to the response, education, the NHS, social care, and other things are all devolved. So you've had Scotland going by a different lockdown timetable to the UK, for example. And of course, that's borne out in the polls that Nicola Sturgeon, Scottish people have more confidence in Nicola Sturgeon's handling of the crisis than they do in Boris Johnson. So I do think that the fact that they've decided to go on the sort of line that Scotland wouldn't have fared as well without the United Kingdom, whether that's true or not, it nevertheless draws attention to the fact that maybe, you know, Scotland, in terms of its sort of attitudes towards how the crisis has been handled, are more sympathetic to Nicola Sturgeon's approach than Boris Johnson's. Although there might not be that much between the two approaches, the fact that these services are devolved and the fact that they've gone by a slightly different timetable, even though they locked down at the same time, sort of highlights the differences between the two leaders and highlights the way that Scotland can go its own way. And you can see that in the polling.
And the interesting thing is, I kind of think that although I completely agree that you're right, then it has the problem of like returning to the scene of political pain, which is, you know, the perception. Well, but it's a combination of the reality that most of the crucial services are devolved, and then Scotland and Wales have both left lockdown in a slower and more cautious way than England has, right? That is just incontrovertibly true. There is a perfectly fair argument to be made about whether or not the Scottish and Welsh governments have dealt with it brilliantly, but politics is comparative, right? Like, you know, and broadly they are successfully winning on the comparative point. But I think if you want to keep Scotland in the United Kingdom, they have to successfully change people's minds about the period we've just had and the role the union played in it. So I basically think that they sort of, if it's an argument we think is a losing proposition, I guess it's a bit like when we talk about like free movement in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, where like a certain type of kind of like Labour MP would be like, but don't you understand? We can't win a referendum if people think free movement will continue. And it's like, well, free movement is going to continue. So what you're actually saying is we can't win a referendum. And broadly, if they can't land the argument that without the United Kingdom Central Bank, without all of those other kind of non-devolved institutions, the pandemic would have been worse, then you might as well just hold the referendum tomorrow. Like, yeah, it's kind of one of those things where one of the things I do personally find quite frustrating about covering this particular political story is it does feel like a large chunk of like British unionists don't want to have to. It's like this thing where it's just like, oh, but if we make this argument we might lose. And it's just like, yeah maybe, yeah, that is unfortunately a feature of the political process. But yeah, so I think it does make sense for them to try and sort of make that case, because otherwise, yeah, what is there other than independence?
Yeah, no, I see what you mean, but I think that it does look too much like political opportunism just to bring it up now, and just sort of in relation to the support that they've given during the pandemic. Because I feel like, and I, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, and it's my oversight, but during the election campaign for the 2019 December election, I feel like the union and Scotland weren't really a focus of the Conservative campaign, of any of the campaigns, actually, in England. And although, you know, their main pledges, you know, stop plans for a second independence referendum, get Brexit done so Scotland can move on, or whatever the rhetoric was. I didn't really think that they fought it on the strength of the union particularly, because they knew that they had such a vulnerability there in terms of their Brexit deal. And so I do think it's almost like, oh, well, now we have to talk about it again. So let's bring it up in relation to the latest thing that we can think of. Whereas they haven't built that groundwork. I don't know if that's fair, but I just feel like it was left out of the conversation last year.
Well, I guess the irony is that I suddenly realised that you, of course, did not go down to Scotland in the last election. So you were doing your towns in England.
But, yeah.
So the weird irony is then, of course, the Scottish campaign was devolved.
Yeah.
And in the Scottish general election campaign, the Scottish Conservatives did have a very kind of strong repeated message of, you know, if you vote for the SNP, there'll be another referendum and it will trigger Scottish independence. Only voting for the Conservatives can stop that, basically, was their kind of core message.
Yeah.
In large chunks of Scotland, coupled with the fact that they are basically the only viable Leave party north of the border. So, or south of the border, I suppose, depending on your perspective. But I think what you are fair to say is that it does kind of expose this central problem that there are really only so many times you can fight an election on a platform of, if you vote for the SNP, we'll have another referendum, without then like having another referendum.
Yeah, I also don't think that that's almost like an excuse not to have to make the argument about the union, because they did that. You know, obviously they did that in the 2015 election, and then in the 2019 election it was vote Labour and you'll get two referendums. But in a way, that's almost a cover for having to actually talk about the substance of the referendum. Like you're saying, you're putting off having the actual referendum or the actual debate that the referendum would force.
Yeah, it does just feel identical to the kind of crouch of doom that Remainers had got into by the time of the 2016 election, right down to the fact that people will kind of go like, but we had a referendum already. And it's just like, well, yeah, sorry, that's how politics works. Sometimes you just got to, because yeah, like the thing about the like vote for us to stop another referendum is I was about to say it's a great message for winning seats in Scotland. It was a pretty good message for winning seats in Scotland for the Conservative Party in 2016 and 2017. The problem in 2019, and this is why on election night, a lot of Scottish Conservatives thought they would be fine who weren't. And if you look at their results, you can see why, because they broadly hit their win number, as it were.
Mm.
Right, so they basically got, you know, the amount of votes necessary to hold on from the perspective of the SNP strength, assuming that the kind of the barrier to people who voted no in 2014 voting for the SNP continued. The big problem was the incredible willingness of Scottish Labour voters to vote SNP in 2019. And again, as you say, right, this thing isn't, if your message is vote for me and we won't have a referendum, that's not actually an argument for an outcome in the referendum. It's an argument for not having a referendum. I mean, in general, these do all just feel like shortcuts to sort of making an argument for why they think the union is good.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So this is a question that was submitted today. What do you make of Number 10's plans to cut Whitehall Department press offices by more than half, bring them all direct central control, bring them all into direct central control, and introduce daily televised press briefings. Now, before we start discussing this, I would suggest that anyone listening to this section should go and read Alva, who's on holiday this week, read her piece on the website, which is headlined, "Here's the Problem with Dominic Cummings' Plan to Shake Up Government Comms." So, Stephen, what did you first think when you heard of this plan?
Well, I guess my immediate thought was, and I didn't think the government had absorbed quite how big of an undertaking it was embarking on. Mm. I mean, I'm all for it because I love transparency. I don't really agree with most of this government's political aims. I kind of assume that the stuff I agree with them on will be the stuff that they'll like. I mean, obviously, betting they'll U-turn is like a pretty safe bet on most issues. But I kind of assume that the bit of the Venn diagram of like things they're willing to like expend any political capital on and things that Stephen likes about this government just do not meet at all, right? So I'm therefore quite relaxed about them having like a thing which is really transparent and will, I think, paralyze decision making. But like one of the problems, not just in the COVID response, but one of the structural problems this government has, because they're so centralizing, but there's obviously, you know, there's not that many of them, right? They have slightly more spats than Theresa May at the start of her time in office, but because they're even more centralized, that they have less, if that makes sense. The center is too overworked for the amount of control it wants. And that is what causes, you know, all number of delays. It's been a problem with the COVID response, it's been a problem across the policy piece, right? And now they are going to invent a single kind of face of the government, who also, crucially, the face of the government reports to the communications director, not to the prime minister. I just think that sounds like a recipe for organizational dysfunction, right? Because it's one thing to like be evasive or indeed, you know, to talk about incredible detail in a kind of off the record briefing. It's quite another to be able to do that on air without looking shifty, without reflecting poorly on the government. PMQs takes a lot of capacity out of Downing Street. I think that is valuable because it is a valuable accountability mechanism, both directly in terms of what the MPs might ask, but indirectly in terms of what the Prime Minister finds out about what's going on across their government while they're doing the, well, what can we say if we're asked about health, you know, kind of preparation stage. But this is going to be like that, but, you know, sort of a lot more intense, with someone who is going to have quite a difficult role with a government that already has, I think, as well as its tendency to centralization, which I think is, you know, well, it is just indisputable. It does have a tendency to centralise power, and no amount of sympathetic briefings about how Dom is not a centraliser will change the basic reality that they do centralise everything. Added to the centralisation, I think that there's a tendency to kind of like panicked announcements to get their way out of trouble. And I think then the press conferences will exaggerate that. The other thing, as Alva said in her really good piece, is that actually like a lot of the people they're getting rid of aren't like press officers. They're people who like communicate with you about like your MOT or whatever. So people will, I think, notice a marked deterioration in their quality of government as a result.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a really good point as well, because the main way that we communicate with press officers for different departments is through the press officer in the purest sense, which is someone who sort of talks you through the policy, tries to defend it, attempts to correct you if you've written it up in a way that they don't like. And all of that, of course, is quite useful because it tells you a great deal about what the policy's intentions are and what the government line is on that policy, which, you know, even if you don't agree with it or think that it's bollocks, then you then you still know what the thinking of the government is. That's why my concern is actually that this isn't a step towards transparency on policy grounds, because it kind of takes, I feel like there is a part in Alva's piece that suggests that it could take some of the power away from individual departments over the communication of their policy. And I think that probably is a problem for transparency, because sometimes, you know, you'll call up the Treasury and say, what about this thing? They'll give you their perspective on it. And the Department for Business will give you a completely different line on it, which suggests that there's tensions between the two, or, you know, gives you a fuller picture of how this policy has been bouncing around government and what the different views are and who should be held accountable. I think if all of that is centralized, or if there's too few press officers left in each department to really give you that kind of insight, then I think that's going to be harder for writing sort of those policy pieces that point out the problems behind the sort of headline announcements. So that would be my sort of quite nerdy apprehension about this new announcement. But what's interesting is this televised thing. I mean, do they think that their number 10 briefings have been going well on TV? You know, was that part of the thinking behind it? Do you know?
Yeah, well, so because the public liked the press conferences, apparently. I mean, obviously they did, you know, they watched them. That is, I think, the other thing which I think, because I agree with, well, I guess I can see where your concerns on transparency come from. I think the thing that is interesting in practice is, as we're seeing with the Treasury, right, you know, a couple of months ago, Sajid Javid walks out, they have their centralised spads, lots of people, including me, wrote a piece about going, you know, this is like the biggest and most significant enhancement of Downing Street's power, basically forever, which, I mean, in theory, it ought to have been.
Mm.
But in practice, fast forward to the present, and the Chancellor still gets to do, like, all of the good announcements. Like, it's like, one of the, like, hilarious, like, unwritten sort of, like, things about their relationship. Then, you know, like, Boris Johnson does a speech about how he's Rooseveltian and then basically gets, like, the rounding error announcements. kind of like, you know, the, like, oh, and we have spent the stationary budget of the NHS on levelling up. Latin. And then Mrs. Sunak gets to be like, aren't I attractive and urbane? Here's a billion, kajillion pounds. Like, yeah, like the... And I suspect in practice, then what will happen is that if you're Priti Patel, right, you're not going to lose your ability to, like, assert your Priti Patelness. Because she's a serious political operator. I'm really worried that I'm coming across as, like, I don't know, like the armed wing of the, like, Priti Patel for PM wing. I mean, I find it a horrifying prospect. I just do think that she's, like, an impressive political operator.
Yeah,
I just don't think that, like, Priti Patel's going to be like, oh, yeah, sure. I'll give up my spinners. No, the National Crime Agency will lose its, like, stakeholder communication, right? Yeah, like, it will be other bits of the kind of government machine that lose that kind of sort of grip. But of course, if I'm wrong, then you do have those sort of transparency problems. I think, yeah, isn't, you know, they felt the press conferences went well. They obviously did allow them to kind of shift the narrative and control it more effectively. Yeah, I guess it's kind of like the 100,000 tests target, right? Like, yes, that did get them out of, like, whatever, like, media row they were in that day.
Mm.
But fast forward to the present day and, like, why are people not shopping, not going out, not taking advantage of the eased in restrictions? Well, because they're still scared on the health front and people basically believe that test and trace is a disaster and the government is inept. Why do they think that? Oh, because of the very public failure to get a grip on testing.
Yeah, no, I think that the televised version of these briefings could still be really useful for us as journalists, because although we've done a number of podcasts discussing the problems with them, they still told us quite a bit about what the government was concerned about. You could tell, you know, down to the minister that they decided to send out, and also when. I think Priti Patel got quite a few of the Saturday slots, which may not have had as many viewers as some of the more sort of blockbuster weekday ones. So, you know, you could probably intuit what was going on in the government, or at least what they wanted to communicate by their choices. And so hopefully that will be the same for these sort of new White House style press conferences that they're apparently going to introduce.
Yeah, and I think, like, my other sort of concern and question with them, right, is there is a certain type of question that people kind of feel they have to ask for TV that I don't think leads to, like, particularly effective coverage of policy. Of which, kind of like, the recent example is the number of times Rishi Sunak has been asked on the BBC, are we in a recession? Like I said, I completely understand that there is a strong TV argument why you have to do that. However, it does in practice mean, because the broadcasters, for understandable reasons, are basically going to be guaranteed a slot, then a large chunk of it gets devoted to questions like, are we in recession?
Mm.
I mean, Dodoy, everything shut. At least everything was shut when that question was being asked. And it minimises, not least because actually, like, you saw this with, like, I know this from talking to other people about their questions, right? This nerve-wrackingness, and what you want is a really specific policy question, but you also don't want your publication to look stupid by asking, like, a question that's deeply boring, in inverted commas, on air. And so I think it does have the potential to change, like, the questions that are asked of power, and not in a wholly positive way.
Yeah, no, I didn't think about it from the perspective of what kind of questions people would want to land in a TV format, but that is true. Because I do remember when Patrick asked his question about care homes, you know, he actually got an answer But I think, you know, I think I remember him saying that if he'd been somewhere else, Patrick Maguire, this is our former political correspondent, if he'd been somewhere else that perhaps was less preoccupied with social care policy, then he might not have been able to ask a question like that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, lots of people were very kind about Patrick's question. I thought it was a very good question. And yeah, it was thoughtfully done and et cetera, et cetera. But it also does show how, like, your institutional incentives allow you to be the best version of yourself, in that we've had a very strong investigation. You had done lots of great work on care homes. That was an issue that was of huge importance to us, our readers, our corporate brand. And it also was a short, sharp TV question and got an answer and an actual news line. But, like, that mostly wasn't because Patrick's very talented, although he is, and I every day, like, do a, like, little kind of, like, stalker's board where I throw darts at a picture of Matt Shawley for stealing him, but it was also partly because of the institutional incentives which allowed him to demonstrate his excellence. And yeah, I do think there's a real chance it will paralyze how the government operates. I don't care about that, to be honest. It will result in a kind of worse coverage of policy. I do care about that quite a lot. And it will take away government communications officers away from, like, that quite important sort of tangible stuff about, like, you know, roads closures, driving safety, all of the stuff that Nava talks about in her piece, and concentrate on, like, the hubbub of Westminster, which will result in a worse quality of governance for people.
Are they getting rid of the sort of old lobby briefing system as part of this?
No, and I think actually for a publication like us, where we'll go if, like, you know, Patrick has a specific question, or if I'm like, you know, go and ask X, I think actually it will work pretty brilliantly for most of those organizations, because, like, there will still be the morning session. So I am less concerned about, you know, what does it mean for, like, local news? What does it mean for us, et cetera, et cetera. I am more concerned about what does it mean for, you know, like, governance and, like, the quality of government we have overall, where I think it will have some, you know, a fair amount of sort of negative knock-on consequences. I think, of course, the other sort of flip side of this is that the interesting thing is, I think, you know, I think it's unlikely that this will be something that it kind of unhappens. I think in an odd way, then I suspect that where it will eventually end up is the person doing the briefing will be the director of comms. Or at least they will have to be someone who reports direct to the Prime Minister, because I just don't see how you can have a situation in which, like, you know, this person is probably going to be, like, the face of the government in a way that is really only equaled by a Prime Minister and their Chancellor. I just don't think it's tenable for that person to, like, report to the comms director.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleague Stephen Bush. We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. I'm laughing because I think someone wrote in saying it's actually Devil with the Devil.
Oh, of course, yeah. No, it would. That would make a lot more sense, wouldn't it?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.